This is The Network Break, a podcast on the state of the business in networking. We discuss vendor moves and news, products and ploys, and provide analysis on product and positioning, and look at the business of networking in about the time it takes to have a coffee, we think. I'm Drew Connery Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow. Greg, how you doing?
Back from Germany this week.
Germany, yes. Mm. Oktoberfest or work?
Work, sadly. I've learned that at my advanced age, I had a birthday in the last month or so, and I'm starting to feel the weight of my years.
Literally or figuratively?
Both. As you know, I am generously proportioned in the midriff. My idea of a six-pack. It's not made of muscle. I think the most disappointing part of the conference was that I didn't actually get to have a Frankfurt in Frankfurt.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah, that's an execution fail right there. But on the
How
bright
did you avoid it, frankly?
But on the bright side, I had a wonderful, wonderful conference. It was called Powering the Cloud. It's a small event. It seems to be sort of an amalgamation of some other more niche conferences, and it's sort of seeing this, you know, as convergence is occurring in conferences, I think in infrastructure we're seeing conferences converge too, if that makes sense.
We're all rapidly coalescing into the singularity.
Well, you know, we've talked about this before, silos in networking and storage and various compute and virtualization are all disintegrating.
Yes.
As they move together. So you can't really sustain, you know, a conference just on networking or a conference just on storage doesn't sort of add up. Not yes. to mention that the biggest companies in those industries run their own conferences anyway. So
yes.
It's kind yes. Well, I tell you what I have come to the conclusion is that for the next 6 months to a year is I will be unlikely to attend the big conference conferences. So I enjoyed this small conference so much, and you know, I was there talking to the CEOs of these companies. You know, when you go to VMworld or Interop or Cisco Live, you just don't get to talk to the people in charge. Mm-hmm. You get to talk to the PR officer while they shuffle you from one place to the other. So really enjoyed the conference. It was a wonderful, small, tight, well-attended, and very valuable conference. Ran into a lot of bunch. So there's a couple of there's two shows coming out on the priority queue feed for packet pushers, which I can just refer to that.
Please do.
So one was I talked to a company called ProLabs who make OEM SFPs. Uh-huh. And we talked about, is there any difference between a vendor approved, certified, blessed with virginal, you know, tears of a virgin sort of thing, and, you know, comes with a price tag that is eye-wateringly expensive that generates those tears. You know, what is the difference between an OEM SFP and a genuine one? The answer is nothing. Uh-huh. It's literally just a license fee because they're all step. Anyway, good conversation there. And another one coming out soon about fancy NICs. So there was a company there, Solarflare, who made some fancy NICs. So I wanted to talk to them about what made a NIC fancy. And
yeah, I was going to ask you, is it a hat or something? What is?
Yeah, hipster NICs? Is that what you're trying to?
Yeah. Does it wear a fedora or a pork pie?
I guess the best way is to listen to the show. It's sort of like it's one of these subtlety things. It's not just that it's got a, you know, it's got all these fancy things inside, custom ASIC that does, you know, flows and virtual NICs and things. So one of the things that Cisco UCS has got, for example, is the ability to take a physical NIC and turn it into multiple virtual physical NICs. Mm-hmm. So the operations, so even though there's only one network adapter or two physical network adapters in the UCS chassis, you can turn it into 256 physical NICs that the operating system sees. Mm-hmm. So the operating system could see, you know, and there are reasons as to why you want to do that, although they're less relevant in the future. Well, this NIC does the same thing. So if you want that feature, you don't necessarily have to pay the UCS tax to get a hold of it, mm-hmm. Which was interesting. So it's a good conversation. It'll be published in the next week or two. We're recording this, what, today, the 31st of October?
Today, the 31st of October, yes.
So expect it, you know, sort of by mid-November, I guess.
Okay. And I just wanted to mention that this is the 20th network break, which I guess is a milestone of sorts.
Yeah, that's not bad, is it?
It's not bad at all.
How long have we been doing this?
Oh, I have no idea. It seems like forever, but...
Welcome to podcasting, where everything feels like forever. Yeah, it does feel like that.
Maybe we started in the summer. I don't know. But it's been fun, and 20 shows have flown by. So
6 months, I guess.
Yeah.
8 months, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I've just realized how I can look it up. iTunes.
there you go.
I should have thought of that first, really. We did. Oh, no, that's not going to work either. Right.
And I also wanted to ask, since we are recording on Halloween, is Halloween a big deal across the pond, or is this just an American thing?
It kind of is. I'm not sure how I can explain it. It is an opportunity to play up. So if lots of young people are turning it into something in the shops, but it's nowhere near as big as it is in America.
Mm-hmm. Your candy makers haven't gotten hold of it and run with it?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, I've just literally had one of my next door neighbors drop off a carefully selected piece of organic chocolate for their children when they come through.
Really?
Yes. She says very picky about what chocolate her children can have, and she doesn't
She's pre-populating the neighborhood.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Fair enough.
I guess so.
Huh. You don't think so?
It sounds a little excessive to me, but maybe I'm just a bad parent. I don't know.
You know, I used to be like that when I was younger to some extent. We believed that, you know, there had to be special, you know, your babies didn't want to eat non-organic, you know, blah, blah, blah. Nowadays, I just give them $20 and tell them to go to McDonald's. You know, shut up. Stop whining.
I'm good with the organic milk, et cetera, but if it's candy, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as they're not. Anyway, whatever. So I'll smile and I'll do the scary, grumpy next door man. I think I could do that pretty well.
Get off of my front porch.
That's right. You know, kids. For sure.
All right. Turning rapidly to the news of the week. Maybe because it's Halloween over here, not a lot going on. But we did have an announcement from Meru. Meru is a WLAN vendor talking about SDN over wireless. Throwing in lots of good open stuff, open daylight, open source, open flow, et cetera.
Yeah, so we're starting to see there's been lots of rumblings around the industry that wireless and SDN are very much the same. Mm-hmm. You know, wireless LAN controllers look a lot like a controller. So
yeah, they've been around for a while too.
Yeah, but they've been doing and using overlay networking and blah, 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 edge. You know, fundamentally the edge model with an overlay, EOE, and so on and so forth. So it seems a little weird that it hasn't happened before now, but Meru's announced that they're actually moving to an open SDN. They're basically using open daylight controllers, which they're offering as their own product, so you can start to use OpenFlow in their Wi-Fi platform. And they're supporting an app store. Have you heard this before?
Where have I heard this? I think it was show 19, as a matter of fact.
Yes, the new Meru App Store, where you can buy Meru. Now, I believe the Open Daylight Controller is, if I remember the briefing correctly, is the Brocade. They're working with Brocade on the Viata controller, and then providing their own apps on top of that controller to administrate the Meru Wi-Fi network, and you can have SDN Wi-Fi. Isn't that great?
So, I'm curious because I understand the role of SDN in the data center and all of the goodies that you can do there. But at the access layer, if I'm just connecting laptops to the network, what do I need SDN for?
Campus. So it's all about matching the campus together. So the big thing that's coming up in the next, how can I say it? What are we've solved the data center. We've talked about SDN in the WAN using overlay networks and dynamic pathing, and that was the talk I gave at Interop in New York was about that. Mm-hmm. And so where's the other two networks that are left? It's campus, the campus LAN and the campus wireless. Mm-hmm. You could talk about the DMZ, but that's just an NFV application. So SDN's more NFV in the DMZ. So campus, big money in the campus, billions of dollars every quarter spent on campus networking equipment. Mm-hmm. And they're all currently depending on spanning tree. And tree architectures that aren't very efficient, and the state of the art in the campus to make things better, lower cost, and, you know, add value, which is always important apparently, is to stack them together with virtual stacking systems.
Sure.
Which is OpenFlow, which is SDN, right? Because what you're effectively doing is bonding the control planes together on one switch somewhere.
I mean, you've already been able to do that though with things like MLAG, or if you want to get a little fancy, you can do Trill or something.
Yeah, but those are still distributed control planes. Mm-hmm. So one in each chassis. But when you do a stacking capability, what you actually do is put a network controller in, because one of those switches becomes the controller or the master. and it owns the master table, the Mac tables and IP routing tables, and also, and it acts to keep them all in synchronization.
Okay.
So it's a very small step, really. All you've got to do is add some APIs and maybe change your internal software a little bit, and campus can be SDN ready.
Okay.
So not a huge step from what you're doing today if you look at it in the right way, if you squint into the sun. But if you figure that stacking is a controller network, right?
Sure.
Because one of them's got to be the master, and then it manages 4 to 8 switches. Well, it's only a small step from there to saying my entire network could just be a one controller or a couple of controllers in consensus. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. Doesn't mean overlays necessarily, by the way.
Sure.
So, you know, it could just be pathing. You know, I'm going to send the packets this way or that way, and if this path is down, send it via that path, which is not down. And then no loops, no. And, of course, in a flow-managed technology, you can add, very importantly, you are immediately able to add authentication and authorization. So, you know, in a company where you go in and add your computer to the Wi-Fi, It's very important to be able to authenticate who's getting connected to the Wi-Fi.
Yes, it is.
But we can't do that with the LAN. Why not?
Well, there's been a lot of efforts over the years to do that kind of thing, 802.1x and MAC and all that, or NAC.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of things there. One is our users were always idiots. They could barely run their Microsoft Word applications reliably.
Come on now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, seriously, we tried to do 802. The only reason we tried 802.1x was because it had to be transparent authentication. We wanted to use the authentication in Windows because users weren't able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we now know is that with suitable motivation, aka an iPhone or an Android or a Samsung, connecting to Wi-Fi, everybody's quite happy to give their username and details and log into Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is driving a trend where, you know what, all of your computers will authenticate before they get to the network, and that's where we're headed. That's why all of the wireless companies that I'm looking at have all got wired products. Aruba, Aerohive, Maru have all got Ethernet switches in their portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to connect the Wi-Fi networks back to the core, but to actually bring those authentication and authorization features to desktops.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So hit your portal, and when you log into your portal, it'll let you go have 2 hours of internet surfing for free while you're at work. And then you can get a $10 upgrade and get super fast access.
Yes.
Give them the cheap tea bags. Yes. Give them the cheap tea bags. So, yeah.
And also, I'd neat that Maru is syncing up with the Brocade Open Daylight.
Yes, I believe they're using
a nod to the Open Daylight project itself, but also a
bit of both.
Yeah.
The way they were talking to me was, yeah, well, it's a bit of both. One of the thing that they were trying to emphasize was that they wanted to use Open Daylight. They're partnering with the Viata for the controller in the first phase, if I get it right, which is sort of this idea that an open controller can be used by everybody. And that's why I believe in the long term, Open Daylight will be one of the most successful controllers. Now, will probably look like Linux, you know, Red Hat Open Daylight and
yes.
Brocade Open Daylight and potentially Cisco Open Daylight because they have one of those too.
They do.
Maybe not VMware's Open Daylight, perhaps, but that seems unlikely given EMC's history. Because it might upset their storage business or something, but seems like everything upsets their storage business these days. But yeah, it's a step in the right direction. Open Daylight, an app store, and an application to do SDN on wireless. That's what we're up to.
Very good. All right, sticking with networking, Cisco is partnering with some manufacturers on 2.5 and 5 gigabit Ethernet, so letting you ramp up some speeds on your existing Cat5e and Cat6 cables.
Can't decide if it's genius or just pure idiocy.
Okay, break that down for us.
On one hand, 1 gig over copper makes, you know, copper is everywhere. Therefore, we should keep using the old stuff. So let's get the Volkswagen, you know, the old Volkswagen Beetle?
Yes.
Most reliable car ever produced. Air cooled, runs like rubbish.
Right.
And you know, it took 40 years for us to take us out the back and shoot it. It was inefficient, it was expensive to own, but it was reliable and everybody's sort of like it's. And I just can't help but wonder if, you know, copper is just stop hanging on to it. Now, that said, if you're have made a foolish decision to actually you know, invest in copper cabling, because I've been telling you for 5 years not to keep buying copper. But if you made a foolish...
So don't blame Greg.
Yeah, that's right. Not my fault. because of this reason, you know, the copper is just not going to work. It can't run, you know, even at 10 gig, you're right on the very threshold of the electrical performance of the wire. Mm-hmm. So to promote the idea of using 2.5 gig or 5 gig on Cat 6 seems like a really stupid idea in terms of the industry as a whole, but reflects the fact that customers can ask for stupid things and vendors can give them equally stupid results.
Mm-hmm.
VHS Betamax. So I think ultimately copper in the ceiling, like copper in the riser, this is where it's really meant for, is for Wi-Fi. So if you've got a Wi-Fi attached at gigabit and you've got copper running to put those Wi-Fi access points in the roofs of building, or and you want something a little bit faster, or as desktops get faster, you know, the 1 gig Ethernet isn't going to be fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
But this seems not a good step forward overall. We should, if you want, you know, just run 10 gig. Why not?
Mm-hmm. So avoid the stopgap. Just make the leap.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, I could see why if you've got a lot of copper, you want more than 1 gig. You don't want to upgrade to 10 gig Ethernet.
Mm-hmm.
But using lots of 10 gig makes 10 gig cheap. So 10 gig base T. Intel recently had a big marketing push around their 10 gig standard and putting it on the chipset on the motherboard of all laptops and servers. So why would we invent this halfway house? And I noticed that the Alliance doesn't seem to have certain people involved. So it's only a very limited number of people in the participant companies.
Right.
So it's only Cisco and a couple of chip manufacturers. No Intel, no Google, no Facebook, no other networking companies, no whatever. So
strictly enterprise.
I don't think it's even strictly enterprise. I mean, unless they can get enough participant, you know, you'd really want to see Brocade, HP, those types of companies joining in the Alliance to make it get scale, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the biggest one, of course, is Intel. Without them supporting it on their chipsets and putting it inside of the servers and the desktops and the laptops, I don't think it's going to get very far.
Mm-hmm. Well, time will out, as always.
Yes, and interestingly, notice who else isn't there? No Broadcom, no right. Marvell, no Cavium, no...
Yeah. Okay, well, something to keep an eye on.
No chips, no other vendors, not actually much of a consortium yet.
Yeah.
All right.
This is a slight change of coverage for us, but you picked up a finding from Pew, which is a research organization that's got a whole research project around internet life, and they put out some findings about online harassment. That's been in the news over here around Gamergate, with gamers getting their feathers ruffled about women asking for games maybe to not be so misogynist.
Not maybe. They saying, you know, I think they found some stats that said that 40% of women play games, and they don't, they're sort of, it's uncomfortable that they always seem to have semi-naked women with wobbly bits running all over the place and while the men run around in armor.
Yes, not to mention the female characters are often prostitutes or victims of violence, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
So yeah, really unsavory stuff.
Yes, or they're the heroine, and really it's just so you can see the wobbly bits run around. And it's just, you know, it's sort of... I'm not... I think that's certainly something, like the Gamergate is sort of based on, you know, people saying we really should have equality in games. It's, you know, sexist or, you know, some sort of not correct. But harassment is closely related to this because the Gamergate people then started harassing people and annoying the people involved and, you know, calling down SWAT teams on their houses and creating death threats and various things. And there's been a lot of stuff on the press, but this online harassment is far more general. It just talks about it. And the numbers, just in the headline numbers, they're talking about 53% had seen efforts to purposely embarrass somebody, 25% had seen someone physically threatened online, 19% said they've seen people being sexually harassed, and 60% of users said they've witnessed someone being called offensive names. So rudeness, bad behavior is rampant on the internet, and I'm not sure what we can do about it, but really what we can say is that online harassment is a thing, and we need to stop it
somehow. Yeah, it's definitely real.
Hmm.
And unfortunate.
Yes, and it's happening in public. So if you say something on a Facebook page, it's like standing in the middle of the street and saying the same thing. And if you did that in the middle of the street, people would come at you.
Right.
Like, it's not does that make sense?
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, you know, when you are sitting in front of a computer in your house, you feel safe. And that allows you, I think, to behave in ways you wouldn't necessarily behave in a public place, or say something directly to someone else who could then respond to you.
Yes, very much so. And disturbing that people think that they could get away with it at such a wide you know, and you know, the old story is when you're looking at somebody in the eyes, it's a completely different story,
yeah.
Perhaps. But, you know, you might be reminded to be grown up, but people have a long way to go. So, you know, as somebody who's been subjected to a fair, you know, myself, as to a lot of personal abuse, specifically from vendors, you know, professional abuse is fine. If you want to call me out for being wrong or incorrect, then fine. But personal abuse is
unwarranted.
To be unwarranted, and also it's very distressing at certain levels, and it causes a whole bunch of I found it very difficult not to respond and start calling names back. You know, it's not easy to be sitting there where people are calling you a range of swear words and to stay silent and say nothing. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
But there is no way that you can win that debate online.
Unfortunately, no. If you're dealing with someone who is willing to engage you on that level, then they're likely willing to take it as far down as it can go.
Yes. And especially when they work for a big vendor, and the big vendor doesn't feel that it's a problem, according to their senior executive. So, you know, a bit childish. I just thought I'd bring that up. I think, you know, we all need to be, we're all part of the internet, and we should be taking some time and care of these things.
I agree. And I mean, it also strikes home to me because I've got young kids who spend a lot of time virtually communicating with folks, and I've heard stories about some of the terrible things. Kids can be cruel, and the internet allows them to be cruel and new and devious in very hurtful ways. So.
Well, there's no refuge for them. It's one thing to be called that in the schoolyard, but another thing when it's in the schoolyard and at home.
And
that's
right.
You know,
and it follows you.
And it follows you, and there's no respite where you can recharge and react and recover.
And have some sanctuary, yeah.
Yeah. Still, enough of that. You wrote a blog post this week for Bracket's new ES twist. Who's Bracket?
Bracket is a startup. I don't know if you remember Ironport a few years ago. They built email and web security appliances. They got bought by Cisco.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Gillis coming out of there with this new startup, cloud-based. So essentially, they're virtualizing infrastructure as a service. They're abstracting the resources of an infrastructure as a service cloud, trying to bundle them up and put some service guarantees around it and some encryption. I think the idea is essentially that, you know, they'll provide you some service guarantees if you've got an application that needs X amount of performance, X amount of compute resources, X amount of IOPS, et cetera. I think it's an interesting idea, and they've got some backing by Andreessen Horowitz, which makes me think, assuming Andreessen Horowitz did their due diligence, that there could be something here. But I'm also sort of on the fence, like, is this something that people actually need? Is infrastructure as a service enough, or what's going on?
Oh, another one. I don't think much of Andreessen Horowitz. Don't believe that they've got magical powers to sniff out a successful startup more than anybody else has.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt, and they claim here a radically different approach to enterprise computing. Well, that sets off my, silliness alert right there.
Yes.
I doubt very much that any of these types of things are going to win over OpenStack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I agree that OpenStack is incomplete. I mean, to jump left, we saw that a company called Cloud Scaling was bought by EMC this week, in what was rumored to be a fire sale of a company that had run out of runway.
Mm-hmm.
I say rumored, by the way. That's the rumor that I heard, is that, and we saw a number of OpenStack companies get acquired in the last 2 or 3 months. But again, because OpenStack is clearly 2 or 3 years away before it's going to be mature and before enterprises are going to be ready to take it on. But the momentum behind it seems to be unstoppable because everybody needs an alternative to VMware. In the same way, in the operating system, Microsoft is the dominant, you know, was the dominant operating system, and we've turned to Linux to give us an alternative. I think OpenStack will be the alternative to VMware, and very importantly so. So if you're going to reinvent that wheel, I'd like to be sure that at least the wheel is approximately round and that the axle goes into the middle somewhere so it's a smooth enough ride, because it has to be better than OpenStack. And I doubt that this matters.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the other thing is, they're here now. If OpenStack still needs some time to mature, that may give them some room to run. But as always with startups, it's a risk. It's a gamble.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm deeply dubious, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are they saying here is their key values? Extend existing service provider models across providers. Mm-hmm. I don't think that hybrid cloud's ever going to be successful because there's not enough bandwidth in the world to make it possible.
Really?
Yeah. If you think about a VM, a 10 gig VM, if you want to move that between providers, you know, Amazon, Google, Azure, aside from the sheerly technology challenges of moving ES or VMs between them, because they're all formatted differently and run differently, and mapping the metadata around them from one to the other, you actually pay an awful lot of money for bandwidth to extract a VM out of a cloud and move it somewhere. So Amazon charges you 6 cents a meg. So you're talking kind of like $150, $200 to move a 10 gig VM around.
Well, I think they would probably say that the eventual goal isn't about moving the VMs. It's having an application instance that can live across multiple clouds so you don't have to move the VM in the first place.
In which case, why am I not using Docker?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Right. So if you're going to, today's applications don't scale across multiple instances.
Sure, but if you're starting fresh with the cloud with a new application, then perhaps you can write it to scale across multiple instances and multiple clouds.
Sure. Maybe. I don't think so, is my experience. You're not going to get your – you're much more likely to buy a new database or a new application that is cloud ready. You're not likely to try and take your existing – you know, Oracle infrastructure or your core line of business app, which you've been writing for the last 20 years, and then just try and shove it into the cloud and make it work, because it just isn't. It's just not the technology that underlies those things is it's designed to run on one server in one place and talk to one database with one data call. You can't shard it. You can't fracture it into pieces. You can't run it as parallelized threads across multiple CPUs. The only way you're going to do that is to redevelop it from the ground up in some of the technology, and then it'll be cloud ready. That's the secret of businesses like Netflix and, you know, all those things, is that those apps would are designed to take advantage of that feature.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, that that as organizations build new apps, they're going to build them for the cloud.
Yeah, but and what I've discovered is that it's just easier to build them into a private cloud because it's cheaper.
That's possible.
I mean, that's what I've discovered when I've done the numbers several times. You look at the price of the cloud, and when you work out a base load that you're going to run this many reports this many days, it's much cheaper just to go and buy a rack of servers and put them in a colo, you know, fractional. I'm talking 1/5 the cost of a public cloud. A private cloud is 1/5 the cost of a public cloud if you have a cloud app.
Right.
Yeah. So even if Amazon has another 43 discounts in the next 10 years, I doubt it'll ever come close to the price of a private cloud. In a colo, right? So you're still renting the space and still, you know, even all the other things, it's still cheaper to do it yourself.
Right. Well, this is an $85 million gamble on some VC's parts. So this is one I'm going to keep an eye on and see how it plays out.
All right. I can easily be wrong. One way or the other.
And if so, I'm sure someone will mention it.
No doubt, no doubt. Well, I'll look forward to having some more stuff to make up for next week.
Yeah, I think we've come to the end of our time. Where can folks find you?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. I've had a lot of fun this week blogging there about, are we overcapitalized on assets and underinvested in human infrastructure? And I've been musing on, is DevOps a reaction to underinvestment in human resources? So instead of spending a million, so here's basically the pitch line. If you head over to etherealmind.com, you can have a look, but here's the pitch, right? If you could spend $1 million on a brand new infrastructure stack like this bracket computing stuff here, or could, if you spend $1 million on people over 3 years, what could you achieve?
Right.
And I do wonder if we're at the situation now where we are in a better off situation spending $1 million on humans, human infrastructure, on the people. And that fundamentally is what DevOps is. You invest invest money in automating and extracting more value from the assets that you have. So you get actually extracting, driving the utilization up through server virtualization or network virtualization or storage virtualization and using DevOps to automate that. And if you could get your existing assets that you've probably spent many, many millions buying and increase the utilization from 10% to 20%, that's $1 million well spent on people. I just wonder if that's a viable argument, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. So if you head over to etherealmind.com and look in Blessays, leave a comment, and I'd love to join in the conversation with you.
I'm certainly pro-human.
I think we've gone too far. Everybody I've spoken to said it's fine that we needed to cut heads, but we might have gone to the point where we're starving our physical infrastructure of actually being operated properly.
I can certainly see that, and I think I'm feeling that sentiment in other areas as well, yes. Part of the issue is that people turn to technology for technology issues rather than necessarily considering the people around it as well.
Well, so here's the thing that I said. I said, I was talking to somebody and I said, well, you know, what we do with our assets today is it's like going and buying a brand new car, driving it for 2 years and never taking it in for a service and then replacing it. Right, because taking it in for a service,
you didn't want to pay for a mechanic.
Yeah, you didn't want to pay for a mechanic, or because the service is too expensive, right? But everybody knows that a car that is operated and oiled and new tires and all that is much more efficient. So I do wonder, if we actually spend some time maximizing the utilization of our cars and improving their operational performance, if we could generate a much more significant. Take, for example, an infrastructure team of 10 people. If you add one person to that team, then you should get a 10% increase in productivity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right. We'll head over to etherealmind.com and leave a comment whether you agree or disagree or want to have your say.
Yes, please.
And you can find me blogging at informationweek.com/interop. And I'm also on the Twitters at interop_Andrew. And, of course, we will be talking at you next week.
See you real soon.
Bye-bye.